thank you so much for sending all the material. I'd rather have more information than not. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, that was a thing during the years that, you know, in the, all through the 70s, you know, there were computers, but, you know, there was no internet. There was no, you know, Google didn't show up until, what, 2002? So, I mean, you know, all that stuff was way in the future. And when people would stop down at the station, you know, musicians, band members, things like that, it really would have been nice to have a little prep material, you know, right. So that, so I understand exactly what you're saying.
What would you do to prep out for an artist that's coming by? You couldn't go to the library and look up Ian Anderson. How would you get that material? You read the liner notes of a record cover. How else would you gather that?
In a perfect world, you would be a guy that had access to all the music magazines.
Right.
That was really that was the prime way. That, and then just kind of bullshit conversations that you would have with any number of people.
Seek out their biggest fan or whatever.
Would come up if you're lucky.
Man, well, it's great.
I had a couple of tough interviews. I mean, like, because I just didn't know really what to ask them. You know, like, and you know, you don't want to ask vanilla questions. You want to ask something interesting.
Yeah. Who do you remember having a tough interview with?
Michael McDonald.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was tough, and he was tough on me too. You know what I mean? He could have been a little bit more gracious. But you know who was with him was Skunk Baxter.
Why do I know that name?
Jeff Skunk Baxter. He played with the Doobie Brothers.
Okay, and that's where I know that name from.
He was a great guitar player. He really had his name with the old Doobie Brothers. And he kind of saved the whole interview because what we talked about was they were going to be playing a show that night at the Coliseum.
So set this up for us, Bruce. So it's WPLR. Is it in the middle of the day or is it night? And Michael McDonald comes in. And did you know he was coming in? Tell us all that.
Yeah, I didn't. I did not know that these guys were showing up. Nobody gave me a heads up. Nobody. I didn't know a thing about it.
Were you filling in for someone?
Yeah. I sat in for everybody.
But the day that Michael McDonald came in, you're filling in for someone?
Yeah, I was doing an afternoon show, so I guess I would have been sitting in for Gordon.
And then there's Michael McDonald. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, shit. And you can't grab your cell phone and, like, let me look up Michael McDonald.
Oh. You're right.
Oh.
You know, just so that you could have, like, three little tidbit items.
Yeah.
That would have been enough. Would have been enough because it's that. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you guys are here tonight to play in town.
Yeah.
And have you been over to the Coliseum yet?
And that's all you need. Yeah.
Did you have your sound check? But, you know, at some point, even those questions kind of get like vanilla ice cream. And you want to just ask something else.
Yeah.
And what Jeff Baxter did was he was so nice to me. And he really saved the interview because he talked about how when they perform, of course, they're all standing up. And and being a guitar player, he has, you know, it's strapped onto him. But he said, you know, when you're really playing a guitar, it's not meant to be played standing up. You should even electric, acoustic, doesn't matter. You really should be sitting down when you play a guitar. That's the proper way to play it, because if you look at the body of the piece,
right,
that curve on the bottom
for your leg.
Is there. It's there for a reason.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and he kind of went on and expounded on the whole topic, and he made it very interesting. That was like something I never would have thought of.
Well, and tell me about that one. Tell me about when it started going wrong. Like, what was so somebody comes in and says, "Hey, Bruce, Michael McDonald's is playing was it the Doobie Brothers playing the Coliseum that night?"
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. Doobie Brothers are playing Coliseum. Michael McDonald's out in the lobby. He's coming in, and after this song, you're going to interview him. And then after you say, "Oh shit," he comes in, puts on some headphones, and here you go. When did it start to go bad? Immediately.
Immediately. Yeah. Yeah. Because when somebody came in the studio door and said that this is who was here, I went into a panic.
Yeah.
Like, immediately.
Yeah.
They hadn't even walked in the room yet, because I knew I didn't have anything in my hip pocket.
Right.
See?
Yeah, if you had 15 minutes to get a couple things together, to go through some albums, to look at some songs, maybe song time, you know, something. Yeah, you had nothing. Yep. Like, they walk in, there's nothing. There's a blank page. You're like, hi. So how you doing today?
Right. Yeah. But at the same time,
do you remember a question?
There were other people that came in that,
right, that are fine.
You know,
it's like natural
degree difference.
Do you remember a question when it started going off the road? Do you remember the question, or you're like, "Oh shit, this is going off the road"?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why. It was so bad, I just locked it out of my memory.
I don't blame you. I've had those. You're like, yuck, you just want to take a shower after. Like, it's part
right.
You want to do better, but part they could have been nicer.
Right.
So, like, all right, so you, early into this thing, you're like, holy fuck, this guy, we're not gelling here. And then Skunk Baxter jumps in and saves it.
And so that was real nice. And I remember Dick Colt saying to me, either later on that afternoon or the next day or something like that. I don't know. He was a very compassionate guy about that, because he understood, because and he wasn't coming from the general manager hat side. He was remembering when he used to be a broadcaster himself.
Right, right.
And I heard his podcast. That was a very interesting one.
After
and by the way, I want to say thank you for the invite today. It's nice to be a part of the station's history. And thanks for the invite. I appreciate
it. Bruce, I got to tell you, I haven't even introduced you yet, and already I'm in. We have bonded over the stink of failure in an artist interview. Like, we have both experienced that, and we both know how much it blows. Because you know what? It's one thing to fuck up at work, but when everybody's listening, it's like, ugh, I'm sweating now just thinking about it. There's nothing better than when they go right, but when they go wrong.
You feel like a six ulcer person on two ulcer pay.
Bruce Mankey, WPLR six man or Swiss Army knife or utility guy, fill in guy, whatever you want to call him. He was that guy to the most important rock station in the United States, WPLR, in the 70s, early 80s, Bruce?
From August 73 to September 81.
Wow. So you were part of that wave when that program director came in, who Rick Allison didn't want to mention. Everybody, I call it the classic lineup, the lineup that I remember most. They were shown the door. So you were out the door with them?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, and, of course, you know, you're nobody in broadcasting if you haven't been fired at least once.
Yeah. It's so, like, you know, in Goodfellas.
It's kind of a badge of honor.
Yeah.
But it was very unfortunate at the time.
Well, sometimes when you're that fill-in guy.
That's an interesting part of the station's history that I don't know if the listeners were able to understand what was really going on, because that whole process took over 2 years to happen. And then the horror went on for only 1 year, and then things started to get very, very good again. And so from late 76 until I was there, and until nearly the end of 81, that was the second wave of really, really great radio for that station, because there was a first wave, and that was from the very beginning up until sometime in late 74, early 75. And the reason for it was the change in program directors that we had. That's what... that's where it starts, you know? I mean, Program directors are not called that for no reason. They're the captain of the ship. And, you know, they kind of set the pace for what everybody is going to do at the station and how they're going to make the station sound. And Jay Crawford was the first program director of PLR, and he was wonderful. He was what I would call a consummate radio broadcaster. He had a great background, and FM, the idea of FM was new to him, but he caught on real quick, and he steered the ship very, very well. And the station was, you know, we were big from the early going. And then what happened was there was, I don't know, something unfortunate happened in Jay's life. It was some personal thing. I don't remember, and I don't think I really know. But he left, and our second program director was a guy named Ronnie Berger, who had worked in New York City a little bit. And he also had his own band that he was the drummer in, and they had a record album on Capitol Records, I think. The band was called Sunship, and they were playing what was the type of music that's called fusion.
It's like jazz fusion, like Billy Cobham?
Yeah, like exactly like that, like Chick Corea and Return to Forever,
yeah,
and Al Dimeola and Stanley Clark and
great stuff. Yeah. WYBC music before they, you know, became what they are now.
Well, I mean they were playing the Mahavishnu Orchestra in '68.
All right, that fills in a piece of the puzzle for me for listening to WPLR, hearing some of that stuff mixed in with rock artists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the FM sound in New Haven, anyway, you know, New York City and Boston is something else. But in New Haven, I put the first footprint of FM with Yale's radio station. At that time, it was the Yale Broadcasting Network, and it was called WYBC. And they broadcast from Hendry Hall, right downtown across the street from the Green.
It was a breeding ground for WPLR jocks.
You bet. Rick Allison, Leslie Palmiter, George Scheibner.
At the time, I don't know if it's still true now, but that was the very first college station that got a FM commercial license, because Yale said, well, we're not paying for you. So.
And then not long after that, and that was my introduction to FM, by the way. I was going to school at Southern. I lived in Westville in a big fraternity house, and only
sounds nice
one
and quiet.
Guy in the house had a nice component stereo system. So, you know, we always hung out in his room, and we would listen to YBC and UNH's University of New Haven, and also the University of Bridgeport.
What was the full-time lineup when you walked in?
Bob Dark was the morning guy.
Yeah.
Jay Crawford was midday from 10 to 2. I don't know who did 2 to 6 before Gordon came down, but...
Before he moved to 10 to 2?
Oh, yes. The 10 to 2, the midday that he did, that was in the second iteration of PLR. So that would have been sometime like from 77 on.
Right, 76.
That's when he did midday. Because he was the, let's see, Jay was the first program director, then Ronnie, then Barry, then Gordon.
Okay.
And we never would have lost our audience if we had gone from Jay to Ronnie and then to right to Gordon.
Yeah,
there's
always
been fine.
Well, there's always that.
Fine.
Yeah.
But everything worked out at all.
You know what? I use the baseball analogy a lot. I mean, the Yankees have always been a great team, but there are years where they're a great team. PLR has had its seasons, but clearly enough winning seasons to be around 50 years later.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy. Because it is, it's exactly like that. You get a certain person in a certain slot. And, oh, by the way, I didn't finish. Okay, so we had Dark early in the morning. Jay Crawford did 10 to 2. Gordon did 2 to 6. Stoney was on from 6 to 10.
Wow.
Up until April of 73, 10 at night to 2 in the morning was Kevin McEwen. And then the station would sign off because that's the way the license was made up. The station had to sign off at 2. But we were able to go 24 hours, and that began in April of 72 when the station got its extension to go 24 hours. Jay Crawford had to hire the first overnight person, and he had three people in mind. I was lucky to be one of them. An old friend of his from AM radio, who was also a good broadcaster, his name was Ray Simone. He was being considered. And then there was this third guy who worked at Quinnipiac College's little WQAQ, and his name was Joe Piazzik from New Britain, Connecticut. And Jay very wisely picked Joe to be the first overnight guy. And Joe, this is where he kind of, he just came in as Joe Piazzik to begin with, but it wasn't very long before he sort of developed this character for himself. And that, and he became Joe from Chicago.
Oh, he should.
And then I called Jay and I said, oh, okay, so you got somebody to do overnight. And he said, yeah, but relax. I'll get you in. Just relax. I'll get you in a couple of months somehow. So in August, I came down to be the afternoon news guy. So I did afternoon news for Gordon's show, and I was very happy with that. That was fun. And then eventually it took a year or two. I didn't get to play music right away, but eventually I got a shot at doing weekends. And I think that started while Jay Crawford was still there. So I got Saturday 10 to 4 and Sunday noon to 6. That was regular. Those were my two shows. And then... They kind of liked that, and I said, okay, well, then you could be like the sit-in guy for everybody else.
That's great.
And there were other part-time people, too, but I lived so close to the station that, you know, if they needed a sit-in real quick, I could be there. So I was the utility guy.
You did a lot of concert introductions and onstage announcements for the radio station.
Yeah, I like those. Those were fun.
New Haven and, Coliseum. Do you have some memorable moments backstage before going out?
I didn't see anything nearly as dramatic as what I heard happened with Jim Morrison. I don't have a story like that.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to beat that one.
It is, you know, it is fun. It's just a very nice atmosphere. You know, you're part of it. And so at some point, they're kind of ready to go. And they just, you know, you get called into the wings. And they said, okay, so we're going to open up the curtain now and go on out and do your thing. And depending on the circumstance, that would have everything to do with how you introduce somebody. Now,
what do you mean by that?
The night that I got to introduce Jethro Tull, it was Halloween night. So that was fun.
That's awesome.
That was at the Coliseum. That was a lot of fun.
Did you have a costume on?
Yes, I did, and it was a subtle costume. The big part of the costume, I owned a used tuxedo from Harold's formal wear. So I had that, you know, and this was all on short notice. I think I got asked about 5:30 or 5:45. Hey, listen, you want to do the stage introduction? And I thought, Jesus, I got to run home. I got to put something together. And it's Halloween. I got to come up with something. So what I had was, and this was the subtle part of the costume, I had a pair of Spock ears. And
great.
I put those on.
Spock in a tux. That's awesome.
The one that's really special, the Rossington Collins Band.
Oh, yeah. This is right after the Leonard Skinner.
After they kind of, you know, had
the lead guitarist
tragedy. Yep, Gary Rossington. And there were one or two other musicians from the old band with his lineup. So anyway, this was at the Palace in Waterbury. And, yeah, this one was really a jewel for me because I'm from Waterbury originally, and, you know, I went to the Palace Theater to see movies growing up. I lost count of how many movies. Anyway, I walked out on the stage, and, you know, sometimes you can feel maybe a little bit jittery, but I was used to big crowds. That didn't bother me, really. I liked it. But this was different because it was the Palace in Waterbury, and I thought to myself, you know, this is like coming home. And I said that to the crowd when I came out. You know, I just introduced myself. People were very nice to me. You know, I got
That's
a nice
cool.
reception. And I told them that, you know, I was from Waterbury, and, you know, that got a big reception, and it turned into one of those things where you couldn't do anything wrong or you couldn't say anything wrong. And I reminded everybody in the audience, I said, listen, you know, I've seen, and I know you have too, you've seen a lot of big shows here. Think of all of the great shows that have been here at the Palace. And if you were at any of the really, really tremendous ones, you know that they, you know, how they made an impression on your life. And tonight is going to be one of those nights. And that made the crowd really go berserk.
Oh, shit. That is, I got chills just hearing that. That's great.
So then I just introduced the band. There was nothing else to say. I introduced the band. And as I walked off, Gary Rossington kind of high-fived me and he said, That's an introduction. Thanks.
And he's heard them all, you know?
So, oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Tell me about covering John Lennon's murder. How hard was it to be on the air during that time?
Oh, it wasn't hard at all. You know, I got to tell you, Chaz, when you know that you're a broadcaster and you know that you're in a moment of history. And that was, this was, let's see, Lenin was murdered on Monday night, December 8th. And the thing that I did was the following Sunday, that would have been the 14th. And this was when they had a big tribute for Lenin at Central Park. That was going on. There was nothing that I could broadcast from that. I was just playing my show from noon to six, but I knew what time, what the time parameter of that thing in Central Park was. So, you know, during that time, you just talk about the week. It was an incredible week in history, and everybody knew about it. So it was that, and just playing Lennon's music and great Beatles songs where, you know, Lennon sang, which, oh my God, were so many.
So many.
So many songs to choose from. It was just a, it was a real nice, it was a nice afternoon. And, you know, the people who called in, they had nice things to say. And, you know, nice recollections and you know, laments about, you know, what a terrible thing it was, of course. But this is what made it such good radio. And the funny thing is, now, of course, this is up here in New Haven that this happened. I don't know if this happened in New York City, but at this, at the hour.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, it started snowing in New Haven.
Yeah.
Oh, you remember that?
I remember that.
So to use that moment, and I said, I remember saying in the broadcast that, you know, this is such perfect timing. It's like the world is getting washed clean with this, with the snow falling. This is perfect. And then it made it easy. I don't know what else, what I played next, but it was something that kind of played to the moment. And it was just, that was a wonderful day. I loved it. I was honored to be able to play that that particular show. It's real nice.
Yeah, it's a moment in history, and there's no place, as a, like you said, as a broadcaster, when the S hits the fan, there's no place you'd rather be than behind a microphone.
Absolutely.
And taking the phones.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
Oh, that's a good one. Gee, you know, every week on certain days, the different record company promotion guys would show up. And it was like the ice cream man showing up. Because every week when these guys would come in, they'd have a stack of all new product. And, you know, some of them were big artists and some of them were groups that nobody had ever heard of, but they had something really great about themselves. You know, they were really good. And anyway, one day the guy from Columbia came in and he had Born to Run. Actually, it didn't have the artwork on it. It was just like a test pressing,
like just
in
white,
a plain white sleeve.
Yeah.
But he came into the studio and he said, "Hey, here it is." And I was like, oh "My God, this was like you know, it was like touching the Arkenstone, you know." And I said, "What's good on it?" And, you know, so I think the very first thing I played was 10th Avenue Freeze Out.
Wow.
And I played Badlands, and then I played Born to Run.
So you were the first one to play Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
Born in Connecticut.
That's cool.
Yep.
That's really, that's a moment.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
about how many times we've played that since and how that's a staple at his shows today. And it's funny you asked, what's good? And he could have said, everything. And you would say, nah, come on, what's good? No, everything.
Oh yeah. Well, see, I mean, these guys, that was their business. I mean, they knew the record, and they expected a question like that. And they said, here, listen to this one. This is good.
Yeah.
This is a good one, you know.
Oh, man.
So 10th Avenue Freeze-Out was, I remember that was the first one I played. It was, that's a great song.
Bruce, do you have a final thought here you want to wrap things up with?
I guess the only thing I can say is that it's amazing that PLR is still what it is 50 years later. We never could have seen that back then. Nobody thought about that. We were too busy living in the moment, you know. So to be here now and realize that this station is still a rock and roll station that's still called WPLR is really in the radio business, that's nothing short of miraculous. And it's wonderful that can you hear that?
Is that a train or?
That's a train.
Better watch out. Open the door, Bruce. Let it come through.
It's my ride. It's good that it came at the end here. It's my ride. I'm gonna have to go. But anyway, happy 50th, and thanks so much for the invite. You guys keep on doing what you're doing. Let's see 50 more great years.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Bruce. And you know what? You made me feel so much better about all of the bad interviews that I've had with artists. You know, like one or two or too many. You don't really reflect on the good ones as much as you should. And those bad ones, just they stink to join up. So every time I hear Michael McDonald now, I'm going to say, fuck you.
Well, when I see you, listen, Chaz, when I see you, we're kind of out of time here. But when I see you, I'm going to tell you about the very first musician that I ever interviewed. It was Buddy Rich.
Holy shit.
And he gave me an education that you would not believe. There isn't time to tell that story.
Oh, he's a tough guy. Like, I heard that bus tape, tape that got out where he was yelling at one of the members of his band.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
did he give it to you like that? Is that what happened? You did this.
Okay. Well, I got into his hotel room. He was playing with a big ensemble. It was a benefit show at the Palace. And I was working in radio in Waterbury. And, you know, we knew that he was there. And it was very easy to get to see him because I called and I said, you know, I'm here from the radio station that I'm from. And they said, oh, yeah, come on down. And I went right up to his room, and I had my tape recorder with me, and I was going there as a news guy. And I was a young kid and, like, wet behind the ears, and he knew it. I mean, like, he read that in a second and a half. And I wish I had the tape of that interview because it was wonderful. For the first two-thirds of it, he kind of batted me around like a pinata.
You're like, when are you going to just let me go?
But you know, he knew why I was there. So what he was doing, he actually gave me $1 million worth of education because he taught me how to not be starstruck by people in the entertainment business. And before the thing was all over, he actually gave me some great material to go back to the station to cut up and make into a half a dozen news stories.
That's great.
He gave me great stuff, but he made me pay for it.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for sharing the memories. Thanks for your part in building the monster that is WPLR and I call home. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, too. Take care.